Well, we have a nice sized group here this morning on the day before the Labor Day weekend. My name is John Hoskins, and I'm with Advantage Performance Group, and I'll be your host today and MC. And I want to thank you for joining us today and welcome you to our web briefing. We want to get started here in just a few seconds, give a few more seconds for people to get online and up to speed with the technology. You should be able to see a slide now on your screens that you're viewing that says Martin Lewis, Principal 3G Selling for September 2009. And that is John Travolta behind that crystal ball, those of you who don't recognize him.
Oh, so you say.
So I say, yeah.
Kevin Dwyer.
Of course, we have the rights for that.
Yeah, if it was John Travolta, I don't think we'd have the rights.
Well, why don't we get started? 801, welcome participants and Advantage partners to this morning's webinar. Our guest speaker today is Martin Lewis. He's the principal at 3G Selling, and he is going to brief us on his knowledge of the whole realm of sales forecasting and how to use forecasting to build and manage your business better. I think that the webinar today, like others that we've run, will be about 55, 60 minutes. We have set aside time at the end of the session for Q&A. So if you want to hold your questions till then, that would be great. Or you're welcome at any time to send either Martin or myself a chat message, and we'll answer the question then. We're going to mute the lines so that we don't have any background noise to distract from Martin's presentation. And let me just give you a little bit more background about Martin. Martin was born and raised in Brooklyn, New York. You'll be able to identify his accent when he gets started, but I'm sure you'll be able to get through that. But the topic today is on forecasting, and I think it's something that's near and dear to all of our hearts. And having reviewed this presentation on a couple of occasions with Martin, I have found it extremely useful, and that's after even 30 years of working sales forecasts in my own company and Salesforce, as well as helping other clients try to improve their forecast accuracy and make it a better tool. Martin founded Market Partners in 1995, and since that time, he's worked on a number of different types of projects across a broad range of industries in the sales function. He's worked with startups, and prior to Market Partners, he was the president and CEO of Drake International for North America. And prior to Drake, Martin was with Digital Equipment in Canada for 10 years. So during that time, he managed a force of several hundred sales professionals and brings a lot of real-world, street-level knowledge to the subject of forecast accuracy and using forecasting as a business tool. So Martin, why don't I turn the presentation over to you? Welcome.
Thank you, John. And it's my pleasure to be here and share thoughts on sales forecasting with everyone. And you're so right, 30 years in sales, self-management for me, and I remember the early days when forecasting was nothing but a zero-value reporting exercise. Today I have a very different view on forecasting and see how it's absolutely one of the most critical business processes in an organization. A business process that's not just to get a forecast, but a business process that can help you build and improve the business. And that's what I'd like to share with people today. And John, I couldn't agree more. If people have got questions, please just IM them to yourself. We have put people on mute. They can unmute themselves. And, of course, at the end, we'll allow people to have questions. So, really, let's start by sharing that. Obviously, today, it's let me just click my slides here. As we look today, it's September the 4th. And the question that I'd like to ask people is, do you know where your business will be on September the 30th at the end of the month? How about the end of next month, the end of the year, or halfway through next year? So where will our business be? Where will our business be coming from? What will it look like? Well, in most cases, the answer is not a great deal of certainty for many reasons. When we look ahead and we try and forecast our business, it often remains very unclear what the future brings. However, for me, and this is kind of the starting point, I really don't believe it needs to be that way. if we kind of go to the Vegas thing, we really don't know where the ball is going to land on a roulette wheel. We know what the odds are. We know the odds of black or red of 50-50. We know the odds of each number. But we really don't know where the ball is going to land. What if we did? What if we had more certainty about what was going to happen? What if we knew that black was 10% more likely to come up than red? Where would we place our bets? Well, I hope we'd be placing our bets on black again and again and again, and we'd be beating the system. And that's, to me, what forecasting is all about. It's about increasing the odds of understanding what's coming ahead. So when we place our bets, we can place our bets in the right area. We can take the money off red and move it to black because we're reasonably certain it's going to be black. Not because we're guessing, but because we know. So with that, let's take a look at how we do in terms of forecasting. Well, a little while ago, Market Partners and a company called CSO Insights did a study of just a little over 1,300 companies worldwide. The study included 500 sales managers, extensive interviews with 50 sales managers, 20 sales operations directors. We looked at 20 CRM systems to understand what is the state of the art. How are people forecasting? What are the best practices? What's happening? And I'd like to spend a few minutes sharing with you our observations, and then maybe we'll see how much this resonates with you. So let's start with kind of the state of the nation. And I'll give you three simple statistics that I feel summarize where we are. 90% of business deals are do not close as originally forecasted. For those deals that salespeople say are 75% probability, only 1 in 10 deals close as forecasted. And finally, over 55% of deals that are forecasted to win are actually lost.
Martin, you had a comment that you made when we were rehearsing this. I forget what you said, a quote from one of the people you interviewed in that research.
Yep.
Go ahead.
I remember the quote that I mentioned. It was that we talked to one sales manager, and he said that we closed 50% of our 75%ers and around about 25% of our 50%ers.
I just love that.
And he was quite serious.
Mm-hmm. and happy and or
absolutely not, proud.
Yeah,
proud.
Yeah, proud. Okay.
So it was one of those double takes, one of those wonderful moments. You think, wow.
So we used to at Xerox. We used to have a comment that I think our division president invented one day in an operating review. He said, "Your forecast has hit the wall, and there were no skid marks.
No warning."
Yes, no warning at all.
It's so true. So yeah. Let's take a look at, this is our top 10. So from the interviews we did, from the research we did, we compiled a list of the top 10 reasons for forecast failure. This was kind of interesting because what we did is we took opportunities that did not close as forecast, and then we went to the customers, the prospects, and we said, where are you? What happened? This was being forecast to close, so why didn't you place an order? So this is my top 10. So these were the top 10 reasons in order in terms of what customers said, why they didn't place an order, why they weren't closed. Number 10, the requirements were changed, that something happened, and so towards the end of the process, the customer said, well, we actually changed our requirements. But bear in mind, the sales team was still forecasting to close that business. Number 9, it went to somebody else. Interesting. Number 9 was it went to somebody else, not number 1. Number 8, the people inside the organization did not have support to buy what they were supposed to buy when they were supposed to buy it. Number 7, what was being presented as a solution did not fit their needs as they saw them. Number 6, they saw no unique value in the presentation, the proposal that was being put in front of them. Number 5, they were unclear about the benefits. If we were to buy this, we're not really sure what it does for us. Number 4, no compelling reason to invest. And tied in with that one, no compelling reason to invest now. So maybe a compelling reason that, yes, this is something we'll do, but there's no real reason why we need to do it now. Number 3, well, we really like it, but we don't really know how we'd buy it, so there was no decision-making process behind it. And bear in mind, the sales team were forecasting to close this business. Number 2, there was no funding available. And number 1, In terms of the sales team, missing information. The sales team did not understand the situation. When we talked to the customer described the situation entirely differently to how the salespeople had described it. For instance, the salespeople had described that we've got these people, that they're decision makers, they're really excited about this, they've looked at the competition, they're going to buy next month. When we talked to the customer, the customer would say, well, we were just collecting budgetary information. Or we've always done business with this competitor, and we were just checking to see. So the sales team had real missing information about what was going on. So there's the top 10 reasons.
This is a great list, and it almost reflects more on the sales strategy for managing that opportunity than it does the forecasting ability. And I see the linkage, but we used to think of four things that could happen to a deal in the pipeline. It could close. It could accelerate in terms of its likelihood to close and sort of come forward in when it was going to close. It could fall back. It could be pushed out and delayed, or it could simply go away. They could say, no, we've made a decision to perhaps go with competition or do nothing. But each of these indicate to me not forecasting deficiencies, but selling deficiencies.
You're stealing my thunder.
Okay, sorry.
That's okay, because that's exactly the point.
Yeah.
It's not forecast failure, it's selling failure. And
okay.
By looking at the forecast, this is how we translate. This is why I'm so excited about forecasting, because really forecasting ties right into selling. If you've got good selling, and we're going to talk about that in a few moments, you're likely to have good forecasting. If you've got bad selling, you're likely to have bad forecasting. So
great.
We'll come back to that theme, but you are so right. So let's take a look at what we found people are doing. So I'm going to spend a few minutes now sharing with you what's happening, and then we'll turn to best practices. And I'm going to share with you what's happening today, because let's reflect on, and maybe you'd like to reflect on, if any of these things are happening in your organizations, and we'll talk about what really results from them. So here are the 10 things that we found at the DNA of forecasting today. Number one is that in most sales organizations, forecasting is about what we call story time. That when we see sales managers working with sales reps on what's going to forecast, it's story time. Salespeople will take as much time as you want to give them telling you stories, telling you about what they've done, what's going on, what's happening, but it's really a story. It is not objective forecasting. So there's a lot of stories going on about what's happening. Number two that we discovered, and I think this is no surprise, is that there is an awful lot of reporting. What we have discovered is that when forecasts aren't that accurate, people tend to respond by putting in more spreadsheets with more columns, more rows, breaking it down further. I'm going to talk about this in a few moments, but it just becomes more and more reporting. We worked with some very large organizations that estimate they're spending a minimum of one day a week on forecasting. What are they getting from that? Virtually nothing, because the forecast is not accurate and it's providing very little value to anyone. Number three, what we call data integrity. So much time is being spent hunting for numbers or trying to correlate numbers. We actually worked with a very large software company where the salespeople knew this, and they would take the time of their sales manager in forecast sessions to just chase numbers. So they say, well, that's not the number I had. The sales manager would be saying, well, I see you made $175,000 last month. And the salespeople would say, well, no, that's not the number I have. I have 135. And they then spend 10 or 15 minutes trying to get the data right. So much time is being spent chasing data.
And, Martin, I presume a lot of this is still in Excel.
Oh, totally. Totally. And we're going to talk about that in a few moments. We found that even some of the, and I can't use names here for obvious reasons, even some of the very large CRM companies who, obviously, their product is CRM, Salesforce Automation, are actually doing forecasting in Excel. They're not using their own tools. Which
Robert's
is
children.
Yeah, fascinating. We also found a lot of confusion between forecast and pipeline. I'm going to talk about that later. But in many organizations, we found that there is often a confusion that the pipeline is the forecast or the forecast is the pipeline, and we think that that is absolutely not true. We'll talk about that. We then found, not surprisingly, a lot of forecasts are optimism and fear. Optimism in terms of let's hope it happens, and fear, and here was a very interesting finding and one that I was not expecting. Many, many self-managers would rather continue to work with a forecast that they know is totally unattainable than signal to more senior management that the forecast is going to go down. Because if you signal that the forecast is going to go down, the pain associated with that is so immense that it's better to just continue with a forecast that you know is totally unachievable and hope that somebody misses their forecast by more than you. Because when it's all is said and done, the guy who missed their forecast by the most is going to get the pain. So it's better to not even signal that the forecast is unachievable. So that was a very interesting finding.
That's sort of the reverse of sandbagging, isn't it?
It is exactly correct. It's the reverse of sandbagging. Then we found that many opportunities or most forecasts are supported by juggling and discounting. That as we get towards the end of the month, the quarter, the year, whatever it may be, that salespeople are juggling various opportunities, maybe some that they were sandbagging, to try and make up for those that they had forecast that aren't going to close, and then they start to discount and discount and discount to bring in business that is unnatural to try and achieve the forecast that was unachievable. We've already talked about probabilities, a favorite topic of mine. So many people go to probabilities, and what does it mean? When you hear that sales manager say, I close 50% of my 75%ers, so what does it mean? So we really think that probabilities lead you down the wrong road. It's so subjective. We found that there's very rarely a feedback loop. At the end of the period, whether it's a month or a quarter or a year, oh sure, we know how we did against our forecast, but is there any feedback or learning loop? And I'm going to talk about that later in terms of best practice. Do we really understand what happened? What opportunities did we close? Were they forecasted? What opportunities did we forecast? Did they close? A lot of reverse engineering and gaming. So salespeople spend a lot of time reverse engineering and gaming. So if we use 50%ers and 75%ers, one very large company we worked with automatically promoted any opportunity at 75% or above into the forecast. So in your pipeline, if you put something at 75% or above, it would automatically be put in the forecast. Well, what does that mean? That just means the salespeople would hold everything below 75% until they wanted it forecast. So reverse engineering, a lot of that happens. And then as John already mentioned, finally we found that forecasting is supported by a lot of Excel spreadsheets, homegrown approaches and tools. Interestingly enough, though, we found that no matter how weak a particular forecasting methodology is, people tend to think it's the best in the world. Sales managers were not shy to show us their spreadsheets and to explain how they did their forecast. It was almost like religion. People showed that, well, we do this and we rank and rate the opportunities this way, then we apply this algorithm. Very complex spreadsheets sometimes. People are defending it, telling us how they built it, believing it's great, and the results are spectacularly bad. So a very interesting observation.
Well, Martin, don't they also generally have like a full-time equivalent person who does nothing but pull all the spreadsheets together too?
Oh, we found that again and again and again, that Excel is not the tool that you want to bring a forecast together in. And
right.
You're right, the amount of time that's spent doing that and manipulating things. So finally, let's take a look at what we call the evolution of forecasting. This is how we found most companies go through forecasting. That the first thing they do is, well, let's call a number. That this quarter I'm going to do $12.2 million. This quarter I'm going to do $230,000. So just calling a number. But that doesn't really do it for people. So then they start to identify which sales opportunities are going to close. So we start to flag certain opportunities as committed or forecasted. Then we go to the probabilities. Then we start putting probabilities and saying this is a 50%er, this is a 75%er. And I want to stress this is not best practice, this is just what happens. So we put probabilities on, usually totally subjective and highly gamed. Then we create weighted forecasts. So if we've got a $200,000 opportunity that's a 50% probability, we put that in as $100,000. That's 200,000 times 50%, which is really quite crazy because it's either going to happen or it's not. So it's either going to be 200,000 or zero, but we put it in at 100,000. So that's the fourth thing that we saw happening. Then once that's been proven not to work too well or give us the information we want, we then do this horrifically complex thing where we start to break down the forecast into different product lines, different business lines, different industries, and the spreadsheets get exponentially more complex. The amount of time that's required goes up exponentially. The value doesn't increment, and the accuracy of the forecast doesn't increase. Then we try then to define, well, a 50% it means that the RFP has been issued. A 75% it means we're on the shortlist. So then we start to try and quantify what probabilities mean in an attempt to get greater forecast accuracy. Invariably, you get no greater forecast accuracy. You just spend more time forecasting. And then finally, people tie probabilities into a pseudo-sales process. So rather like I said, you know, 30% is a lead, a 50% is qualified, a 60% is an RFP. So we kind of try and put probabilities along the sales process. An absolutely crazy thing to do because what we can have an opportunity at the very late stages of the sales process, at the closing stages. But we know that we're not the incumbent. We bid this for strategic reasons. It's unlikely that we'll win. So we've got a late stage opportunity that's a lower probability. Just the same as we can have an early stage opportunity. A customer that's always bought from us is looking to upgrade, buy more from us. They've always bought from us. It's only a lead. It isn't going to happen for 9 months maybe. But that's like a 90% probability. So the idea of tying probabilities into the time of the sales process is, again, just so flawed.
Well, Martin, I have to say, quote-unquote, busted. I've not only done all these things, but I know clients that do them all the time. And so you've described the current state. Let's tell us what's the desired.
That, exactly. So that's kind of what our research study told us. Some things that I think were not expected, some things that we expected, but I think the state of the nation was much in a much sadder array than we expected. So let's move to forecasting best practices. Let's spend the rest of the time looking at best practices. So the first thing is a forecast should be a triangulation and should be made of three components. We call these historical performance, market vectors, and sales pipeline. I'm going to go through each of these, and then I'm going to really spend most of the time on the sales pipeline and how we can really increase forecast accuracy and bring a lot of value to our business in the area of sales pipeline forecasting. But let's deal with the other two first. I think they're important. Historical performance is when we have what I call run rate business. It's business that follows a particular trend. It may be a cyclical trend. I did a lot of, way back in the 1970s, I actually did a lot of forecasting for a brewery in England. And their sales were very, very predictable on what they were selling this time last year. So we could use the trend over this week, this day, last year, and the year before. And the weather. The weather, we used to use the weather every day. We put in a 10-day weather forecast in the UK for various regions to forecast how the brewery sales were going to be. Because when the sun came out, people switched from the heavy dark beers to the lagers. So it was a forecast that was based on the trends in time and the weather. So we could forecast that way. Historical trends obviously help when we have a high level of predictability, have a high volume, and you segment. One of the things we're working on with sales organizations again and again is to segment the pipeline. Maybe if you look at a particular salesperson or a sales territory, maybe 70% of the business coming in that pipeline is run rate business. So we try and segment that out. Let's not get that confused with the discrete sales opportunities. So let's segment out what is the run rate business and forecast that using trends and using data like the weather or whatever it may be that gives you a trend line. So that's historical performance. Market vectors is another segment of the pipeline, and this is really where the part of that business is going to be impacted by the market. So this is people who, and we've worked with organizations who have, let's say there's three major players in the market and they have 22% market share. And no matter what they do, their share is not going to change much from 22%. So if the market is growing by 3%, guess what? They're going to grow by 3%. If the market is receding by 5%, guess what? They're going to recede by 5%. So the part of the business that is tied to the market can be segmented off and forecast by market vectors. Things that impact it could be various strategies. Maybe you're doing a program, so maybe in a particular region we're investing heavily in the market. So that could grow market share or competition. So when's this successful? This is successful when it's market driven, when there's predictable trends, and once again, you segment. So when we've segmented off the run rate business, when we've segmented off the business that follows the market, we're left with the sales pipeline, which is where I'm going to spend the rest of the time. The sales pipeline is opportunities that are classified at various stages of development. They have a projected close date and delivery date, and they're ranked and prioritized in some way. So this is a sales pipeline. It's effective when we're moving beyond simply supplying to demand. It's not run rate business. It's discrete opportunities, and it's sales driven. So this is the heart of the sales forecast. So now the question becomes what I promised. How can we increase forecast accuracy? But how can we not only increase forecast accuracy, how can we increase the pipeline velocity? How can we increase win rate? And how can we increase organizational capability all in one shot? So I believe the answer is very simple. The answer is we have to focus on the buying process, not the sales process. It is when the customer is going to buy that we should be forecasting, not when we're going to close the business. I know that sounds so simple, and it almost sounds like just a play on words, but most sales organizations are forecasting when they think they're going to close the business. They're not forecasting when the customer is going to buy. Clearly, it should be the same thing, but by focusing on when you think you're going to close the business, you're almost guaranteed that the accuracy is going to be low. If we start focusing on when the customer is going to buy, things change. So let's take a look at that. Let's just spend a few moments thinking about this the other way around. Not when we're going to close the business, but when the customer is going to buy. And let's look at how we can improve forecast accuracy, increase pipeline velocity, increase win rate, and increase capability by understanding this. So this is a very, very simple, generic buying process. And I don't really believe ever that customers follow a generic buying process, but I do totally believe that markets do buy in consistent ways. Markets do follow a buying process. So here's a simple one, which goes from a customer just in steady state, recognizing an opportunity or a problem, assessing what they need to do, defining what they're going to do, evaluating alternatives, making selection, negotiating, and then making a decision. So a very simple buying process. So we can then say, let's build a sales pipeline. Let's build a sales pipeline that reflects the buying process. We're going to divide that down into, and again, I'm going to be generic, make this simple, four steps of we've got a lead, we're qualifying, we're proposing, we're negotiating. But we're going to tie those stages of the sales pipeline into where the customer is in their buying process. For instance, if an RFP lands out of nowhere on our laps, the customer is at the evaluate stage. We're at the propose stage. We're not at the lead stage. We're at the proposal stage. We just haven't been involved in the previous stages. So that's the sales pipeline. Now, a lot of selling is reactive. A lot of selling is we talk to a customer when they're in the steady state. They recognize that they have an opportunity or a problem, and they come to us and they say, well, you know, we decided to do something about this. What can you tell us? Can you come in, do a presentation? They then define what their budgets are. They come back to us with a proposal. So we're reacting to their buying process. And in some ways, we're just really participating on those lower four steps. What I'm advocating is that we have to drive and be part of the buying process. We have to gain much more knowledge about the buying process and not simply react to it, but drive it. So we've got to move into those higher stages. We've got to help them define what their problem is. We've got to help them recognize that they have an opportunity. So how do we do this? How do we ground this?
Martin, I have a question for you just from your experience and talking to so many customers in this research. Do you think that salespeople spend enough time looking at those last two stages in the early part of the sales cycle and getting answers to how would you make a decision and what selection criteria do you have for that decision?
In most cases, the answer is a categoric no.
Hmm.
Unfortunately.
So do they wait to the end? Or?
They wait till something goes wrong.
Hmm.
It's a sad statement of fact that salespeople, if they get engaged early, that's terrific. But as we go through the selling buying process, optimism takes over, and a very strange but very understandable human psychology happens, that as we perceive we're racing towards the close, the last thing we want to do is ask any questions that may trip us up. So asking questions such as, is this funded, when we think we're about to close the business, is the last thing we want to ask, because we don't want to hear no.
Mm-hmm.
So it's human nature, and I'll just repeat that as salespeople get closer to the perceived closing time, the questions they ask that may lead to a no or tripping them up go down, because we don't want to hear bad news. And that is so much part of why forecasts go bad.
Well, and if you believe that, you know, process drives behavior even more than maybe coaching or training, the focus on the buying process might drive different sales behaviors than focusing on the sales process.
Oh, I so totally believe that. I believe that forecast accuracy is the outcome of good selling and thus good process.
Mm.
And without good process, without good selling, forecast accuracy is never going to be achieved. I also go so far as to say, unless you tie the sales pipeline into the stages of the customer's buying process, forecast accuracy will never be achieved.
Interesting.
So let's take a look at how we can achieve forecast accuracy and good selling at the same time. Now, there is a trifold available, so the slides I'm going to share with you now, the next few slides, have a lot of text on them, but all of this is available on a trifold quick reference guide that's going to be available right after this from your APG representative. So let's take a look at what's on that trifold. What we've done here is, here are some best practices at that early stage of buying. When the customer is at that steady state recognized mode, here are some best practices of what we can do. These are the kind of things, if we practice these things, that are going to lead not only to good selling, not only to increasing the win ratio, not only to increasing the velocity, but absolute forecast accuracy. So I'm just going to pick number one here, participate in customer planning sessions. What a great way to discover what priorities are on customers' minds. What a good way to influence what priorities are on customers' minds. So if we're participating with a customer in their planning sessions, their business planning sessions, we're much more likely to understand what's going on in their business, in their buying process. As we move forward to qualify, again, a lot here. I'm just going to pick just that fourth bullet to talk about. But these are the kind of best practices we discovered that allow us to drive that buying process, understand that buying process, speed up the pipeline, and accurately forecast. So that fourth bullet, understand or develop a compelling event and reason to invest. Oh my, in this economic climate, this is the one that I would pick and put up in neon. Is there a compelling event, a real, true, compelling event? Not in our mind, in the customer's mind. Customers are not shy of things to do today. There's a lineup of sales reps outside every possible prospect's door of salespeople with great proposals, all supported with great ROIs. But is there a truly compelling reason why that customer should buy, and buy now? So if we can't find one, and if we can't develop one, it's unlikely to happen. But if we understand it or develop it, maybe it will happen. As we move forward through the buying process, and again, my language is we're moving through the buying process here, not the selling process, we're moving through the buying process. At the proposed stage, we've already talked about it, that last but one bullet, surface any concerns or anxieties. This is human psychology. It is very difficult when we're at this stage to ask those questions. Hopefully we've asked them before, but to surface any concerns, any anxieties, to look for the problems, it's far better to find them than for them to find us with business that doesn't close as expected. Then as we move to the negotiate step, the kind of the final step we're going to focus on, the third bullet I'm going to focus on, quantify the costs of delay. Is there any reason why, in the customer's mind, they need to make the investment today? Can this be put off? What are they going to lose in terms of revenue, competitive advantage, market share, cost savings? What are they going to lose per month by putting off this decision? Again, if there is no cost of delay, then business may not happen as forecasted. So those are the four areas in the selling buying process, things we can do that's going to increase our forecast accuracy, plus make our selling much healthier. And then finally, if we flip over, and I can't do this on the screen, but if we flipped over that trifold, we're giving you a 3x4 checklist, 12 questions that we can ask that prevent forecast failure. So what we did is we looked at why are forecasts failing, and then we said, how can we make this simple? What 12 questions could we ask that really will lead us to preventing forecast failure? Well, we've divided this into three categories. Firstly, their situation, the customer's situation. We already talked about number one, is there a compelling event? Is there funding? Can they get the money? Is there money? Obvious, but this is the one that was right on that top 10 list. Where are they in their buying process? Oh, what a great question, because so many salespeople do not really know where opportunities are in the buying process. We just know we submitted a proposal and we're really keen to close that business. But are they just seeking information? Is there a compelling event? Are they about to buy? And then when will they buy? So those are the kind of the top four questions. Obviously, we can abstract from there, but those are the four top questions. The second of the three lists of four, our solution. How good does our solution fit their needs? Do they perceive that we offer unique value? Do they see that our solution not only fits their needs, but is unique in amongst all alternatives they may be faced with? Are there any critical dependencies? That is a huge one. We're selling, and I'll make something up here, we're selling software, maybe. And so we're just selling software. What's the customer buying? The customer's buying our software. They're also buying maybe training from somebody else how to use that. Maybe they're reorganizing their department to take advantage of that software. So to them, they don't see this as just buying software. They see this as reorganizing a department and making a huge investment in training. So often we're only selling a component of what the customer needs to do to gain the results that they're looking for. I've seen, and we continue to see, so many situations where we don't think about what the customer is buying in totality. We think about just our component of it. And our component is fine, but it's the critical dependencies that are the problem. So yes, the customer would buy our software, but they really don't want to invest in that training for another year, or they don't want to do that organizational realignment that it's going to take to invest in our software. They don't want to do that until maybe next year or whatever it may be. So it's the critical dependencies that are critical, not our component of the total solution. And then, do we really have the support and credibility across the organization? It's interesting that maybe 10 years ago, this would have been, do we have the decision makers buy-in? Today, we don't believe in the notion of a single decision maker. We believe that decisions are made in customer organizations through a dynamic network of decision influencers. So we no longer say, do we have the decision maker on side? Do we have support and credibility throughout the decision network? So those are kind of the questions we ask. So the third of the three lists is the test. So I love this one. How do we know? How do we know this to be true? Who told us? Can we confirm this with someone else? Maybe somebody in our organization, our champion, is saying, yep, this is going to happen, this is going to happen this month. Do they really know? Is there something that could trip them up? Are we confident in the information we have, and could anything change? These are the things, again, that prevent forecast failure. By asking these questions, how do we know this information? Who told us? Can we confirm it? Are we confident that we truly understand the situation? Could anything have changed, or could anything change? Again, by asking these questions and answering them, we can go a long way to essentially getting rid of forecast surprise.
So that, you know, Martin,
John.
I'm just looking at this 3x4, and you mentioned the story is one of the first things that it almost says, like, if you can tell me the story and answer these questions, it's a good story, but if you don't, it's not a good story.
Yeah, I don't want to hear the story unless it's grounded in objectivity.
Yeah.
I don't want to hear all about how this is a guy we used to do business with, but he left with this division, went to that division, now his cousin's running this, and I don't want to hear all of that, right? I want to hear, where are they in the buying process? Just point to me. Point, where are they in the buying process? Well, I'm not sure about that, but his cousin's taken over this department, and he's a really good friend of my neighbor, and, like, okay, that's all great stuff. Where
right.
are they in the buying process?
Well, you know, it's the conversation that occurs over that opportunity between the manager and the rep that it's either of value or it's of no value. And what you've done is given us a great job aid here to make it more valuable and then more predictable.
I hope so.
Yeah.
So let's summarize what the best practices are. So by way of summary, let me give you kind of step through what we think are the six foundational points of best practice sales forecasting. Number one is, when it comes to the sales pipeline, we have to map the specific market's buying process. So as I said before, customers buy in predictable ways. We've got to understand what that buying process is, and we've got to have a way of objectively saying where is somebody in their buying process. And this really doesn't matter whether the buying process lasts a few days, a few weeks, a few months. People buy in a predictable way, and we've got to understand where they are. Are they just fishing for information? Have they got budget? Are they making a decision? Where are they in that buying process? Number two, then, somewhat obviously, having done that, we then want to categorize all of the pipeline opportunities by not probability, not where they are in some pseudo-sales process. We want to categorize opportunities in the sales pipeline by where they are in the buying process. Then we need to separate pipeline and forecast. Huge difference. So we have a sales pipeline, and I believe that the sales pipeline should represent every opportunity, every sales opportunity we're investing any time in whatsoever. So all of our portfolio of opportunities, no matter how flaky, how early, no matter what they are, should be in the sales pipeline. The forecast is something very different. The forecast is comprised of a subset of the pipeline that are promoted into, if you like, the forecast. I think the best practice is that we have two categories. We have, these are the opportunities that will close. They are forecasted. And then these are the opportunities that we can make happen. These are the opportunities that we don't think, we're not so confident in, that will happen. These are opportunities that we think we're going to have to make happen. Clearly they won't all happen, but this is kind of the secondary ranking of forecast. So we have these opportunities that we say, we understand where they are in the buying process. We're not totally confident they're going to close, but these are opportunities that we can make happen by doing various things. Then we can look at, do we want to try and do that? So we promote sales opportunities from the pipeline into the forecast. And I personally like the two ranks of we'll close and we can try and make these happen. Then we're going to emphasize that forecasting is a business management process, not a reporting process. And by that, and I really believe this is the absolute key to value-added forecasting. We move forecasting away from being reporting, and we move it into a business process. What do I mean by that? Well, I've got a couple of sub-bullets here. It means that we do reviews and feedback. At the end of the forecast cycle, whether it's a month or a quarter or whatever it is, we take a look and we say, well, what did we forecast? At the beginning of this month, we forecast to close $500,000 worth of business. What happened? What were the surprises? And here's the twist. We say, What can we learn from that? What can we do differently in the future? If this sounds like coaching, it absolutely is. And this is where we collide coaching and forecasting together, which is so foreign in most people's minds. That's not a natural fit. To me, it's a totally natural fit. Coaching is all about making a commitment, going and doing something, and then looking to see how did it work. Did it work out as we expected? If not, why not? What can we learn? What can we do differently going forward? Forecasting is the place in sales where we make a commitment about what's going to happen. Forecasting and coaching are absolutely a natural pair in my mind, and we should start using forecasting for coaching.
Martin, can I ask you a question about learning and adjust as well? I've seen customers who have sort of historical data that says we need this much in the pipeline at certain probabilities, and I know you don't like probabilities, in order to make the forecast. Is that kind of analysis looking backwards the kind of thing you're talking about? I mean, what's your thought about
it? Yes, it is. Absolutely, we should be doing that. And
okay.
It's interesting, this rule of thumb of we need three times is so wrong in most situations. We should calculate out what we need in the pipeline to meet our goals. That could be the topic of a whole other webinar, but a lot of the work we do with companies is exactly that. We call it pipeline planning. Let's segment it. Let's look at run rate business. Let's look at sales, the different opportunities, the different sources of revenue, and let's plan analytically and objectively what the pipeline should look like to support a particular result.
Okay, good.
So that's to me, going back to step four here, looking at how we can get out of this loop of always doing what we've always done and hoping for a different result. So turning forecasting into a coaching process and putting this review and feedback loop into it. Number five, triangulate. We've talked about this. Segment the business. Segment the business and focus on run rate business a different way. Focus on market-driven business another way. Focus on the sales pipeline another way. And then finally, and we've kind of implied this as well, supporting tools and systems to look at what tools and systems do we need to support the forecast. And if we don't have the right tools and systems, don't try to do it. It just takes up too much time chasing your tail. And we found, especially as the economy has got tight, business results have come off, we found that companies are spending more and more time on forecasting. They're putting more and more tools in place. They're making forecasting more and more complex. They're imposing more time on people doing forecasting, and forecast accuracy has not increased. So we're spending more time on a bad job. So I'm a real believer that if we don't have the supporting tools and systems to make this work, don't even try. Make it simple, make it work. So again, that's summarized on a trifold that's available from the APG representative. I'd summarize by going back to the roulette wheel. This is what it's all about. It's about understanding that our business is not simply random. It's not 50-50. It's not like playing roulette. What we want to do is we want to provide a 50% increase in forecast accuracy. And this is what we're finding with most organizations that adopt these kind of best practices. They'll increase forecast accuracy by 50%. In some cases, it's been even more dramatic. And what does that mean? And I think this is all about the betting analogy, that if you knew black was 10% more likely to come up than red, where would you place your bets? To me, this is the heart of forecasting, that it's about understanding what's happening in the business. It's about understanding how people are performing and placing our bets where we're most likely to get the results. So with that, John, that's my summary. We've covered the waterfront of what's happening in forecasting today, some of the practices that people are adopting that aren't best practice, and then hopefully we've spent the last half hour looking at some of the best practices and how forecasting is not just simply reporting. It is the very heart, to me, of good selling. It's the very heart of good sales management, of coaching, of understanding the business, and it's a value-added exercise. It's a truly critical business process.
Well, great. Martin, I think what we should do is open the lines for Q&A, and then I'll review the call to action for the session. And we do have a question already on the chat panel from one of our participants that I'll I'll put forward to maybe stimulate some more discussion. We have about 10 minutes left. So the question that's come from one participant is, at what point in the buying process do you recommend adding something to the forecast?
I think that's a terrific question, and it goes back to the sales opportunities to have different characteristics that sometimes it could be very early in the buying process. If we know that customer is a customer that only does business with us, if they're reordering, if they're adding on, upgrading, those kinds of things, that could be in the forecast at a very early stage of the buying process. That would be unusual. That would be totally unusual. So the usual stage is when something is funded, when there is clearly a decision process, and we understand that we've got a solution there that fits the needs, and we're convinced that, not that we're convinced, the customer's convinced it fits their needs and provides unique value and there's a compelling reason to buy. That, to me, would be the usual time, but I really want to say that I don't see it tied into a temporal basis. It's more tied into a situational basis.
It's almost like the quality of the answers you get to the 3x4 questions might tell you when to put it in.
Exactly, exactly.
Okay. Well, thanks for that question, Liz. Martin, I have a question for you on standards of forecast accuracy for, let's just say, a sales manager managing a group of 6 to 8 reps. They have, I'll make this up, a couple hundred thousand a month to produce of X product sales. What tolerance in the 30-day forecast and 90-day forecast do you see as being reasonable, you know, plus or minus some percent of accuracy?
And you brought up something very important, the 30-day forecast, because I think that we tend to use the terminology of 30-day forecast and a 90-day outlook or something like that. So the 30-day forecast, we believe there should be a high degree of accuracy. It should be plus or minus around about 10%. Now, I'm going to quickly qualify that by saying, and it depends how much of their total business is run rate. We're often finding that a very large degree of a sales manager's business is run rate business. The run rate business should be very accurate. The run rate business should be plus or minus about 5%.
Mm-hmm.
The larger the overall percentage of run rate, the more accurate the overall forecast should be. If there's no run rate business, if there's no run rate business at all, and it all comes down to new identified sales opportunities, then I think we can go plus or minus 10 or even 15%.
Let me open it up to participants. We have the lines open. Any questions from the panel of participants that we have? I do think the lines are open, but I have one other one, Martin. I could talk to you all day about this. When we meet in Petaluma this afternoon, the notion of a conservative sales rep versus a sandbagger, or no, conservative being the sandbagger and then the other being overly optimistic, I find that personally when I did a lot of forecasting back in the Xerox days, I sort of formed an opinion about a particular rep, and I'd say, well, you know, that's Charlie, and Charlie's always pretty optimistic, so I'm going to judge. You know, do you find, is that a reasonable behavior on the part of the sales manager?
Oh, yes. That, you've opened up a huge topic, which I did not include today, but we'll just touch on it. I absolutely believe that it's the right thing to do. The wrong thing to do is to go to Charlie. You've got to have accountability all the way through the system. You can't go to Charlie and say, I don't believe you. I want you to change your forecast. Because the moment you do that, Charlie is off the hook. It's no longer their forecast. You coach Charlie on how to get more forecast accuracy, because we're going to do this review feedback loop. So we coach Charlie, but we allow Charlie at the end of the day to call his own forecast. We don't go back and say, I don't want my management to see that. I'm asking you to change that. Because the moment you do that, Charlie's off the hook.
Got it. And so, it sounds like you're recommending in each cycle of the forecast review or pipeline review that the first phase of that agenda with that rep is to review last month's forecast.
Totally.
And say, how did you do against last month?
Absolutely. What happened?
Okay.
What were the surprises? And then this is not a beat-up session. This is a coaching session. If we find that Charlie is just incompetent, then we have a different type of conversation with Charlie and we free up his future. But whilst we're working with Charlie, it is coaching, and it's our role to help Charlie become the world's best, most accurate forecaster. So it's not a beat-up session.
Okay.
So we really separate forecasting from beat-up sessions. And forecasting is, okay, so what happened? What were the surprises? What can we learn? How can we apply this knowledge going forward?
Okay. Well, other questions from our audience?
Hi, John. This is Cindy.
Hey, Cindy. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Well, a beautiful day here in Marin, so can't complain.
Very good. Martin, it's a pleasure to meet you. This is Cindy Damanowski, and I'm curious to know your thoughts around coaching early in the sales process when we're servicing a lead and qualifying a prospect.
Yeah, well, Cindy, good morning. Pleasure to meet you. I thought you were going to ask about my accent.
I'm curious to know about that too, Martin.
Well, I'll give you the quick answer to that, then I'll come back to your question. I speak three languages. I speak English, Canadian, American, every one of them with an accent.
Okay, and I hear a bit of each.
Yeah, that's my background. Coaching early in the sales process, I think, is the best place to provide coaching. One way to make my blood boil is to talk about this wonderful term of opportunities that are above the funnel or not yet in the pipeline. I truly believe the pipeline of the funnel should be everything we're working on, and where we can, as a sales manager, spending time coaching people at the early stages is going to yield considerably more opportunity for us than coaching people at the end of the selling process, because that's the chance when we get to really understand the customer's buying process, influence the buying process in a way that just can't be done at the later stages. So I'm a very big believer in, of course, we have to balance our time. We have to do early and late stage. But the early stage opportunities where, unfortunately, so many sales managers don't spend time because it isn't going to deliver a result today, but that is where you're setting up your future.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Yeah, I actually had a meeting with Ken Beto, the worldwide vice president of field operations for Autodesk, and he shared with me, I asked him if there was one wish in terms of what you would like to see, what would it be? And he said, my one wish would be that our sales management team spend more time at the early stages of opportunities than at the late stages.
Right.
And I just so agree. There is so little we can do to influence opportunities when they get in those late stages. There is so much we can do at the early stages.
Yeah.
I think, didn't our friend Mr. Rackham have some research on that too? Talked about when the sales manager should be involved in the cycle.
I haven't seen that, but I just everything I see just reinforces that. I saw
Sarah
from the Sales Executive Council that reinforced it as well.
Yeah.
Just makes so much sense. Gosh, if we're there trying to help salespeople discount to close business, that's not really value added. But if we're there helping salespeople to really discover what customers are doing, what their priorities are, what their plans are, and how to influence them, how to best present our products and services in a way that's going to make them compelling, that's where we're going to get results. And interesting, that's where we're going to get forecast accuracy as well, because we're going to understand those customers, we're going to understand their buying processes, we're going to understand their priorities, and guess what? Business is going to close as expected.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions from our audience?
My pleasure.
Any other questions from participants? We've got about a minute here to wrap up, and we'd certainly accept other chat questions if you want to put them in writing. One of the things that we always want to do is put a call to action at the end of these webinars to give you an opportunity to learn more, and Martin very generously has offered a focused consultation by telephone to create a plan for you to help you implement some of these practices in your own organization. To get your 2010 forecast accuracy up. I think this is a process that does take some time, but I can tell you from having been in the sales world for 30 years and helping sales leaders do a better job of running sales forces, Martin's delightful to talk to for any amount of time, and he's just a wealth of knowledge and experience, and an hour of his time on the phone is well worth it. So I encourage you all to contact your Advantage partner in charge of your account if you'd like to have some of Martin's time to talk about the issue of forecasting in your organization. And Martin, thank you so much.
Pleasure as always.
I hope you have a nice long weekend up in Santa Rosa and fly your plane and get to drink some wine or something.
I'm looking forward to all those things, actually.
Okay. Well, until the next time, thanks so much. And thanks to our participants for joining us this morning. Take care. Have a great weekend.